There's a very experienced senior teacher. He trained in Thailand and Ajahn Chah's forest lineage with Ajahn Brahm in Perth as well. And just as I said, that always feel is, yeah, it's very special that we can all meet and do this together and have the time spirituality in our week and listen to teachings. Very knowledgeable teachers. So thank you. Have an amazing evening and looking forward to it.
Yes, thank you. Okay, let's begin by doing our Pali chanting. For those of you who need the chanting sheet, there's some more chanting sheets around. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Iti bi so Excellent. Well, thanks everybody for hanging around and let us begin. So this is the week two of a four-week series on Introduction to Buddhist Meditation. Some of you were here last week, some of you were not. So I'm going to give a brief recap. I'll be doing this each week. So last week we focused on the foundations of meditation, specifically on the practice of conduct and how conduct is a foundation for meditation, and on how the to get started with meditation, we have to focus on the body. Now, the meditation practice that we're doing for this period is mindfulness of breathing. So breathing, of course, is an aspect of your body. It's a function that your body does. Don't think of your breathing as an object. We're going to talk about that more later on. But the breathing is something that you are doing. Okay? It is an energy. It's a movement, a pattern. It is life. And by bringing attention to that, we are synchronizing and tuning our mind and our consciousness into, quite literally, the rhythm of life. And this is where the power of the breath meditation happens. Because we are doing that, then that life and that energy that's in the brings stillness to our mind and to our body. When we think about meditation in this way, we tend to remove our ego from the practice. If we think of meditation as being, I am going to do my meditation and I am going to concentrate and I am going to do this meditation exercise and I am going to, and there's a lot of I there. So it's not about you. Actually, these are ancient practices. They've been done for thousands of years. It's also, I should notice, not particularly Buddhist. Like, I'm obviously teaching this within a Buddhist framework, but mindfulness of breathing is a very universal practice. You can certainly find it in other Indian spiritual traditions and probably in Christian and Sufi and other traditions around the world as well. So from a Buddhist perspective, obviously we have our lens on it and our particular purpose that we undertake this practice. But it's not as if you have to be Buddhist to do this meditation at all. It's just about tuning into your breath so that your breath becomes an energy that is soothing you and calming you. Think about what this means, right? At a very basic level, what it means is that you learn to exist as a harmonious being where your energies are like each other and the different parts of your mind enjoy working together. And your body and your mind are not fighting each other. That's really what the state of peace in meditation is. So that instead of all of our emotions and everything conflicting and all of that tension, actually everything works together. That's the aim, especially this stage in the meditation. So from the meditation on the body, establishing mind on the body, the next stage in the meditation we focus on is feeling awareness. So these four teachings are, in fact, going to follow the course of the four called Satipatthanas, body, feeling, mind, and dhammas, the last one. So we'll talk more about this as we go on. But the second one is the aspect of feeling, all right? And so that's what I'm going to mostly talk about for today. Now, I think probably most of you have meditated. Is anyone here who has never meditated ever? No? Everyone's done some meditation? Great. Excellent. So I'll bet it hurt. Right? I mean, has anyone ever done a meditation where nothing hurt at all in the course of the meditation? I mean, maybe, but unusual. Yeah, it's unusual. And one of the things that, Alex, welcome, Ishika, just in time.
Just
in time. One of the things that, classically what people say about this is that the meditation or the mindfulness exposes the suffering which is inherent in your body. Right? So that there is a pain and a tension which is always there in our body, and a lot of our lives is actually driven by wanting to escape from that. And we're seeking comfort and we're seeking pleasure and we're seeking distraction because we don't want to acknowledge that it's actually quite painful to feel all things that we're feeling. So pain, of course, like physical pain, is neutral, right? In and of itself, it's not really good or bad. It's okay. It's just pain. We've all felt it. Whatever, but it's not particularly nice. So in the course of your meditation, you will learn to endure pain, right? And you will learn to have that patience to put up with painful feelings. That's both necessary for meditation and also a benefit of meditation. It's a useful life skill to be able to put up with discomfort, especially with things like boredom, right? If you're going to do a regular meditation practice, you're going to be bored, okay? There's going to be a lot of times when you're like, oh, this is going nowhere, whatever, okay? It's all right, just be patient. And you're going to experience sadness. They call it, the Pali word is niramisa domanasa, is spiritual depression. And niramisa domanasa is that feeling that you have when you long, oh, when will I realize those liberations that the perfected ones abide in? The great sages talk of such happiness and such freedom. When will I have that? How far am I away from that? Right? The Buddha called this niramisa domanasa, spiritual depression. Better than worldly depression, okay? It's not great, but it's better than worldly depression, okay? It's already on the way because it's leading to something. It's making you raise those questions. So you will experience these different feelings, and they will come and they'll go in many different ways, and that's fine. Now, don't fetishize painful feeling, okay? It's what some meditators do and some meditation methods, unfortunately, will teach. Pain is your teacher, they will say to you. Okay? Now, look, when I say don't fetishize your meditation, I'm not kink-shaming anybody, okay? if that's your thing, okay, fine, okay? But not in the meditation itself, okay? It's not pain. Of course, you can learn from pain, because pain is just a thing, and you can learn from anything, all right? Okay, you can learn from anything. You can learn from a leaf on the side of the road. You can learn from a stray thought that wanders in your mind. You can learn from anything, because everything is impermanent. Everything has the three marks, impermanent, suffering, and not self. So you can learn from everything. So, yes, you can learn from pain. But pain itself is not like does not have a special significance in the practice of meditation. In fact, in the suttas, when the Buddha was teaching meditation, he rarely talked about pain, okay? Pain in meditation, he rarely talked about. I'm going to say maybe 2% of the suttas that talk about meditation talk about painful feelings, something like that. I mean, I just made that up, you realize, so don't quote me on it. But unscientifically, 2%. But overwhelmingly, what he talked about was pleasure. He talked about the pleasure you're going to experience in meditation. And he talked about this on and on and on. It is so much so that in some cases, the word sukha or the word pleasure stands for meditation itself. So many of you may have, if you've been in the Theravada tradition, you do the meal offering, and then they chant the Anumodana. They go, Ayuvanno Sukham Balam. Right? You've heard that phrase, Ayuvanno Sukham Balam. So the phrase sukham there is pleasure or happiness. But in the suttas, that's explained as being the four jhanas or the four absorptions, okay? So that's the real meaning of sukham in that saying, right? So the word sukha actually means meditation, right? So that is I'm afraid, that is the bad news, okay? You are going to have to experience a lot of pleasure. I'm sorry. No excuses, okay? No, and I don't want anybody saying, oh, but I'm not worthy. Oh, but I don't deserve this, okay? I'm just going to say this once. You do deserve it, okay? You are worthy, and you should feel happy, and there is no moral superiority to feeling depressed and painful. It's okay to feel happy, and it's okay for you to feel happy, all right? There's nothing that makes you specially deserving of being suffering or any of those things, no matter what your messed up brain might tell you. And in the clarity of mind, in the clarity of peace, you will realize that happiness is a natural state of being. And happiness arises naturally when there is harmony, when the tensions in our mind and body are resolved, and when our mind is orientated towards what is wholesome and what is good, it's happiness is not something that is inexplicable. It has its conditions, and through meditation we develop those conditions and we realize that happiness is a natural state. So it's nothing personal, okay? It's not about you. It's just how the mind works. So we work with the way the mind works, and it's natural that you will feel that happiness, right? So the course of meditation, we learn how to feel that happiness, and we learn how to evolve that happiness through the practice of meditation. Now, we're going to do in a minute some mindfulness of breathing meditation. So I'm going to talk about happiness in that specific context right now, and then after the meditation, I'll talk more about the Buddhist theory of happiness or pleasure, generally speaking. So in the mindfulness of breathing meditation, how it normally goes is that we begin meditation, first of all, we begin with a period of mindful awareness. All right? So this is how I'm teaching meditation. First of all, mindful awareness, maybe a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes at the beginning. Now, in that practice, we are abiding in equanimity. We are simply watching what is happening inside our mind and our body. We are aware of those thoughts. We are aware of those thoughts. We are aware of perceptions. We are aware of memories. We are aware of feelings and sensations. And we just equanimity, right? Not attaching, not pushing it away, not trying to hold on to it. Now, there are many different Buddhist meditations that do this kind of thing. And if you've learned Goenka technique, like the Vipassana technique in the Blue Mountains, if you've learned Mahasi technique, if you've learned like Zen, Zazen, if you've learned, I think, what do they call it, Tibetans? They call it... Dogen. I think it's Dogen, right? Similar kind of thing, yeah? And other like secular mindfulness practices and so on are also very similar. So these practices are broadly speaking all similar. And if you are used to practicing one of these methods, just keep doing that. It's fine. Right? And we actually asked my meditation teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai, about this in Thailand. And he said, yeah, it's the same thing. Don't worry about it. So these are just differences in meditation method. So just do whatever you're used to. So I'll teach that according to the particular practice that Ajahn Chachai teaches. So that's the basic idea there, is that we get some, what we call in Buddhism, sampajanya, or situational awareness. That means we have a broad contextual awareness of where we are and what we're doing, okay? How we are, like what mood are we in, right? How does our body feel like? What kind of thoughts have been plaguing our mind? Oh, and you sit down, you realize, that thing that's been sort of caught in my mind for the whole day, you know, I realize, you know, I haven't been able to let go of that. Or you realize it's something that's been, you know, hurting you or something like that. And you just get an awareness of that. And so the purpose of this is not like a really deep insight or anything, but it's just to give you that perspective so that you're not so caught up in the stuff that's been going on. You just have a bit of perspective around it so you're not so reactive, or awareness and less reaction. So that's where we begin. And it's good to begin like that, generally speaking, with any kind of meditation. Rather than just sitting there and just grab hold of the breath, it's best to spend a few minutes getting some situational awareness. And then when you feel you're ready, then intentionally say, now I'm going to pay attention to the breath. And you will find that your mind is much stickier, and you will actually stay with your meditation much better if you come from a place of awareness. You're very intentional about how you pursue. So then we start paying attention to the breath, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, okay? Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And initially, that movement is simply air, right? It's just air moving in and out of our lungs. And we experience that as a touch sensation. It's a physical sensation, stimulates the nerve endings. Now, you can experience that in different ways. Some people at the tip of the nose. Some people experience it at the top of the lip. Some people experience it more going through the body. Or you can experience it as breathing in and out of your belly. Or you can experience it even as like your whole body breathing in and out. Right? different modes of perception. So don't worry too much about that. Just be aware of the breath wherever the breath feels comfortable for you. I think it's quite individual, so I don't want to insist on that. But the main thing is you're comfortable with the flow of the breath. Right? Breathing in, breathing out. And you have a sense of ease with that. So not so much thinking, oh, I've got to sort of poke at the breath like this, and more thinking, I'm more like you're lying lying at the beach, and the waves are coming gently in and out and rocking you very gently, and you just feel like, oh, that's a nice feeling. So we're primarily aware of that physical feeling of the breath, and through that process, we should be able to see, first of all, the breath calming down. So the long and more rapid breath that we start at the beginning of the meditation becomes shorter, softer, more smooth. Right? That's the first sign of breath meditation. Second sign of breath meditation is we feel that same tranquility spreading through our whole body, so that there's a holisticness to this practice. It's not just the breath, but in fact, obviously our whole body is part of that same field of energy and field of experience. And, you know, that's, if you're, for a meditator, this is obvious. You're just experiencing everything and the breath is happening within that, and you can see those energies also calming down. And then finally, that breath will become so still and quiet that it feels like it's barely there. And this is the fourth stage in the first part of mindfulness of breathing. Sometimes you can feel like the breath is completely gone, or you're not sure if it's even there or not, or maybe it's just like very, very subtle. So this is a sign that, why is it like that? Again, think of what I was saying before, that the practice is about like resolving the tensions in meditation. So if you think that like we're in a state of tension where things are pulling against each other, and then we sort of resolve that, so things are no longer pulling against each other but are just comfortable to be with each other. So this is why we don't need so much oxygen, because we're not fighting. Our body is not fighting with itself, and our brain is not fighting with itself. Right? Brain uses a lot of oxygen. So when we can calm down our brain, just less oxygen is needed, and everything's working together well. So this is the first, what we call the first head trap, the first stages of mindfulness of breathing, and that's mostly what we covered last week. So for this week, we're going to be looking at feelings, okay? So when the mind is peaceful, it will start to feel pleasant. You'll start to feel a joy coming up into that breath. And that's when you start to really realize, oh, yeah, this meditation is some good stuff, okay? It takes a while, so be patient. We can't force this, okay? You can't accelerate it, and you can't like optimize it or anything like that. It's just how it is. But what you can do is you learn over time to tune your mind, okay? Now, when that feeling first comes in, right, it feels like something a bit arbitrary, like you're not used to having that feeling with your breath. So you feel like my breath is here and it feels like this, and then this feeling, oh, it's pleasure comes up, maybe joy comes up. And I'll talk more about this later on, but it comes up in different ways. And maybe you feel it in your body, maybe you feel it in your head or your mind or something like that. So long as the breath and the feeling are separate things, then your mind is not unified. The feeling is, in fact, part of the breath. We see it inside the breath. It's another layer of the breath, another dimension of the breath, which has always been there, but which we haven't noticed because we haven't tuned into that subtlety of the breath. All right? So think about this cup, and you look at this cup, and this cup has a functional aspect. It holds a drink. And then after a while, you might look at that for a while, and then you might think, oh, what is that cup made of? Right? So you know this cup, you know it can drink and so on, but you're still not quite sure. Is this made of ceramic or is it made of plastic? It's not entirely obvious. Right? But that quality of that cup was there from the beginning. It's just that your perception of it has become stronger to know exactly what that is. So this is what happens with the breath. So don't be fooled by anything that happens outside of your breath. Thoughts, feelings, memories, insights, emotions, all of these things, visions can happen. And as long as these things are separate from the breath, then your mind is not yet unified. It doesn't mean these things are either good or bad, right? It just means that the mind is not unified. So that's not your meditation. Your meditation is the breath. That's what will take you to nirvana. Those other things will not. All right? So this is why if you're sitting there meditating, then maybe you get a vision, you see a light or something like that, you think, oh, pay attention. Oh, that light is nice, right? And then you're like, should I pay attention to the light or should I pay attention to my breath? Well, that's doubt, right? That's what we call vichikicca. It's one of the five hindrances, which I'll talk about in a later talk. So these are the things that create that doubt in your mind. So be sure in your mind before you start the meditation, for this meditation, my breathing is the meditation, nothing else, all right? The whole world can blow up, okay? We could have a nuclear bomb dropping on Sydney. I mean, right? And you'd be like, oh, I'm going to die in meditation. Very cool way to die. Okay? If you've got to go, what better way? Seriously. So don't worry about any of those things. When you're in meditation, you have to have that commitment and to say, this is what I'm doing for this period. All right, so let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. So we have the most people, folks are sitting on the chairs, but if you want to sit on the floor, please feel free. There's some space over here on the carpet. We don't have cushions, unfortunately, but you are most welcome to sit on the floor if you're comfortable doing that. And I discussed a bit about meditation posture last week. Oh, and by the way, if you did miss last week and you want to catch up, the talks are recorded by Michael, and he's putting them up on lokanta.live, so you can look at Lokanta website, the Monastery at the End of the World website, and check the talks, which are put up usually a bit after. So, yeah. Okay, so sit quietly. And let the awareness settle down into your body. Just be aware of whatever's happening in your mind and your body. Noticing any tensions or shifts. Noticing any discomfort. So noticing any feelings you may be having, moods of excitement or boredom, happiness or sadness. Until you feel like you can watch with equanimity and see what's happening without reacting to it too much. If it helps, you can name those things, noting, thinking, or feeling. Now we begin with mindfulness of breathing. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Evenly, steadily. paying close attention to the texture of your breath, noticing the roughness of it or the smoothness of it, the coolness or warmth of it. Notice how it feels. Notice how it moves. Take an interest in your breath. Now, as your breath becomes more peaceful, as the touch of the breath becomes softer, and notice that inside that breath there's a gentle, pleasant feeling. Something that's softly uplifting in there. It's vitalizing. Something in the breath that touches your heart. Something in it that takes away your sorrows. And it allows that simple joy to arise. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Now coming near to the end of the meditation. I want you to bring your awareness back into the senses around you, listening to those birds in the distance, clock ticking, sound of my voice, feeling the touch of cloth on your skin, pressure of your seat, and just giving your mind a minute or two to adjust back to normal. Then reflect back over the course of the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself, what just happened? Why did it happen? What was my mind like at the start of the meditation? What did my breath feel like when I first started paying attention to it? What were my emotions like at that time? Then, as the meditation went on, how did that change? And how did my breath change? Did my breath feel connected to my body? Did I notice those feelings of pleasure coming up inside the breath? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sa, sa, sa. Okay, very good. So I'll just take a short break, 5 to 10 minutes. Grab a cup of tea, stretch your legs, go to the bathroom, and then we'll come back for the Dhamma talk. So somehow that got muted. Okay, are we back? Okay, hopefully we're unmuted. So, all right. Is the sound okay at the moment? Sounds okay, thanks, Sarah. How's England, by the way? Cold and wet?
Yeah, how did you know?
I've been a monk for 30 years, there. I've developed these intuitive abilities.
Incredible.
It just somehow came to me. I'm like, in this vision, I'm like, it's England, it's in the middle of winter, it's probably cold. Okay, fine. Fine, all right. So we're going to talk about the evolution of feeling and especially the evolution of pleasure. And when we're considering pleasure, then it's almost something which is taken for granted in our society, that pleasure or happiness is elusive and ultimately, more or less unattainable. How are we going?
We only quickly down 1 degree, so I'm not sure.
Okay, are there other people with you in other talks at the moment, or are we clear outside? What do you think?
You mean another room?
In other rooms, are there people doing talks at the moment? If not, we can open up, because otherwise they can open up. No. Yeah. I think we're good. But it's just that if there are other people there, are the rooms being used? If the other rooms are not being used, then let's leave these doors open. All right. Yeah, we'll just leave the doors open. Sometimes people can come outside. All right. So we think of happiness is elusive, and what is it? I think in the American Declaration of Independence, is it? It says that we have an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Which one of these is not like the others? So we don't actually have a right to happiness, we have a right to the pursuit. I mean, there's something strange about that formulation. Like, if you have a right to the pursuit, that kind of means that if you attain happiness, that you're deprived of your right to the pursuit of happiness. That the pursuit is more important than the thing, which kind of explains a lot about America. I think Elon Musk tweeted just the other day saying, people were right, money doesn't buy you happiness. Only took him $800 billion. So, Rueni, welcome.
Thank you.
So just in case you're wondering about that, maybe how much money you need to have it. 800 billion, still not enough. So that pursuit, right? And that pursuit is driven by something which is primal, something which somehow kind of amplifies itself and expands itself as you go on. It's never sated. And the sutras talks about this as well. You have the parable of the same king Magadeva, who pursues dominion and conquers all of the lands of the earth, and then who thinks, looks up at the sky and thinks, why don't I take the heavens as well? And, well, that doesn't end well for him. So the pursuit of happiness, always looking for something and never finding it. But also, there's also, I think, something about our culture. Like, I think it's also, it's not that controversial to say that happiness lies in simple things, mm-hmm. right? We also know that. To see our loved ones, or to be at peace in nature, or to be simply at rest at the end of a busy day. And there are many things that actually are just very simple things that actually bring us happiness, and it's not that complicated. Somehow we seem to forget those things and then do the other thing. So when it comes to meditation, right, meditation is these days often marketed as if it's a solution for everything, and it's not. And meditation is not going to make you happy if you're unhappy, and it's not going to solve your problems for you, and especially it's not going to solve your problems if you keep doing the things that are making you unhappy, right? So don't think about it like that. So sometimes people think, oh, I'll go to work, I'm going to get really stressed, I'm going to do all of these things, and then I'll go home, I'll do some meditation, I'm going to de-stress from work and it's going to be okay, and that's how I'm going to learn to cope, right? Now, on the one level, coping is better than not coping. So if you can use meditation to cope, okay. But what that tends to then do is to stop you from questioning, why am I doing all those things that's making me unhappy in the first place? And so your meditation will not actually progress. And in fact, what will happen most likely is that after a while you'll get frustrated because your meditation's not going anywhere. And think, well, and obviously meditation is working, it's not good enough, I have to try something else. Ketamine. That'll teach. So
it's realistic. It's instant therapy. Yeah. Isn't it? It's very realistic.
Ketamine.
I think it's now instant
therapy. Ketamine's a drug widely used in Silicon Valley, which has dissociative effects. I read a brilliant article last year which was basically talking that ketamine is the drug of our times, and the madness of all of the tech bros can be largely associated with their use of ketamine. But anyway, moving ahead. So we look for happiness then in the wrong place. So from a Buddhist point of view, we start, if we want to build true happiness comes from character and from conduct and from how we're living our life. If we look at something like the Metta Sutta, for example, it's teaching meditation, how to do Metta meditation and love all sentient beings and so on. But the first third of that meditation is all about how to live a good life, to be capable, to have integrity, to be content, to be caring for others and so on. These are the qualities, the personal qualities, that we need to develop, right? So don't think of meditation as like a kind of a brain hack that can sort of change the way that your mind is, that can solve those problems. unfortunately, and again, this is, I already told you one bit of bad news, which is that you're going to have to develop pleasure in meditation. The second bit of bad news, if you want to develop meditation, you're going to have to be a good person. I'm sorry, okay? That might seem like a challenge, but you're going to have to start by saying, how can I be a better person? How can I be kinder? How can I care about others more? How can I be more content? How can I be less selfish? How can I develop all of those personal qualities? These are the foundations of your meditation practice. The Buddha said that these things bring with them a blameless happiness. Anuvajjasukha, blameless happiness. And that blameless happiness has an interesting quality to it, all right? When we do something bad, then we feel guilty, right? So we feel badness because of it, right? Obviously, if we're not sociopaths, if we are a sociopath, we don't feel guilty. Congratulations. But if we are not sociopaths, we do something bad, we feel guilty for it. And if we don't do that bad thing, we don't feel guilty. So that kind of pleasure is kind of an absence, right? You may or may not feel that as a positive feeling. Sometimes you do. Maybe you give a gift to somebody and you see their happiness and you feel happy yourself. It's a positive feeling. You actually feel that. Sometimes it's just an absence. So when the Buddha was talking about developing happiness in meditation, he often described it in this way, like, oh, the happiness of absences. So he said, for example, if you're sick and you're lying in bed, you can't get out of bed or move, and then later on you recover and you regain your health and you go off and you live your life. Oh, you're happy, right? But that happiness doesn't necessarily consist of anything. Or another example he said is, what if a person who's released from prison, right? They're trapped in prison, they get sent outside. They're happy to be released from prison. But that feeling of happiness to be released from prison doesn't actually consist of anything, because a dozen people would be released from prison and all experience different things. Some people will have a joyful reunion with their family. Some will wander down King's Cross in the middle of the night, where they'll hear some random busker singing a song about being imprisoned and burst out in tears, which is what happened to me one time. I was the busker, by the way, not the And so it doesn't actually consist of anything, but it's the freedom from those oppressive feelings. This is the first level of the happiness you experience in meditation. So sometimes you will experience that as a pleasant feeling. Sometimes it's just the absence of oppression and guilt. But even that absence has a lightness to it, right? It's nice. Subtle, but it's nice. So that's the first level. Now, then as we continue with meditation, let's say we start the meditation itself and we start to build up and refine those feelings. Right, so the happiness of meditation is not something which is separate from the emotions we have outside of meditation, but we are able to develop it in a much more refined and sophisticated way. So when we start to meditate, what actually is happening is, because of our focus, because of our because of mindfulness, because of the positive qualities that we begin bringing to meditation, then the negative forces in our mind start to diminish. Now, we characterize those forces in the mind, negative forces, as the five hindrances, which I'll talk about in the final talk. But those hindrances will start to diminish. And as those hindrances diminish, then you start to feel that happiness that arises from the freedom from those hindrances, all right? Now, this is really important to understand this detail. Why? Because when people sit down to meditate, that's not really what they notice. When people sit down to meditate, they notice, oh, my shoulder's itchy, or my back's sore, or, oh, I'm thinking a lot, okay? And they think that this is what the meditation is. But these things are actually incidental to your meditation. What really matters is that through the meditation, the hindrances are gradually being abandoned, and that is starting to free the mind. And ultimately that manifests, first of all, as a relief from anxiety, from sadness, from anger, from all of these emotions that might have been plaguing you. But as you go deeper into meditation, it's not merely the absence of those negative feelings, but it's also the presence of the positive feelings, the presence of happiness and joy. And you start to feel that which arises in your meditation at a certain point. Now, in mindfulness of breathing meditation, that arising of the pleasant feelings tends to be quite slow. Now, this is very personal, and we don't compare yourself with others. I'm just generalizing here. But typically, you'll find that the mind has like a more or less neutral feeling, and then as you go deeper into the meditation, it becomes like tranquil and you have like a peacefulness to it, but doesn't feel necessarily like really pleasant as such. It just feels nice, it feels tranquil. And then as you go deeper, you feel the pleasure and the joy will start to arise in that. And that can take a long time. By long time, I mean both in a meditation, but also in your life when you're developing meditation. It might be many years of you meditating and you're going, oh, they keep talking about this happiness. Where is it? I want my money back. Damn, I didn't pay any money. Tricked me. Okay, so it can take a while. So you don't want to push it and you don't want to force it, but it's useful sometimes to just adjust your perception a little bit. So what you can learn when your mind starts to become peaceful in meditation is you can learn to switch your perception a little bit. So this is something I would recommend specifically in breath meditation. If you begin the breath meditation like we did just now, and then you become clearly aware of your breath coming in and out, and you can be mostly aware of that, and you feel the breath becomes still, okay, and the body becomes still. And so, you know, usually this might take maybe 10, 20 minutes at least in meditation. So let's assume your meditation is going pretty well. You've been practicing for maybe 20 minutes or something. Your mind feels bright, you're clear, your energy is good, and your body feels tranquil and your breath feels tranquil, okay? So when you're at that point in the meditation, then if that's when those pleasant feelings can start to arise. And if you're not feeling that, if you feel stuck, right, if you feel like you've been doing this many times and those pleasant feelings haven't come, then just gradually turn your attention to it and ask yourself, where is that pleasure? Right? And the crucial thing to do is as little as possible. Like ideally you don't do anything, but if you have to do something, you do as little as possible. You just say, oh, where is that pleasure? Yeah. Same thing is, it's just a shift in perception. Like the same thing is if you're drinking a glass of green tea. And actually like green tea has like almost like a subtle sweetness undertone on it. Like it tastes bitter, but it has like almost a sweetness as an undertone to it. And so if you just taste it very, there's almost like a sweetness there. So this is what's just like switching that perception just a little bit. And then you can start to feel that feeling coming out, all right? So don't be in a rush. I promise you this is real, okay? And the things I'm going to talk about in a minute are real, okay? They're actual experiences. But though initially, the feeling of pleasure is what we call bidhi or rapture, okay? So rapture is a sense of uplifting joy, okay? Now, that joy technically is not... that joy technically is an emotional response to your meditation. It's the feeling that you get when you go, oh, ice cream, right? And you go, oh, it's nice. And the taste of the ice cream when you eat it is the sukha, okay? It's a pleasure. So these two distinctions. So the rapture of the piti is like, nice, yeah. And initially in meditation, you'll feel this coming up. And that piti can manifest in a lot of different kinds of ways. And initially, it'll manifest in things like the hairs will rise up. You have goosebumps. You can feel a chill down your back. You can feel like electricity shooting through your body. You can feel like vibrations. Sometimes your body will physically vibrate or shake. Okay? All of these different perceptions you can have. You can feel like your body is becoming extremely light and you're starting to float up from your meditation seat. Don't open your eyes. Don't look down, okay? Okay? If you feel like you're floating, if you're sitting there meditating, your eyes are closed and you feel like you're floating, I recommend getting a webcam, filming yourself meditating. Okay? And if you are, in fact, floating, just put it on YouTube. Okay? But you feel like that. But it can, it's extremely varied. So it can even feel the opposite. Sometimes you feel like you're incredibly heavy, like you feel like a rock, but not heavy in a sleepy way, but heavy in a strong way. You're sitting there feeling like you're just a statue made of granite, nothing can move you. Or maybe you can also feel like your body's expanding, like the Michelin Man, and you're just like going there, whoa. So all of these kinds of experiences can happen. Sometimes it can happen. Sometimes you feel like laughing. You break out laughing or crying, anything like that. So these are all the different emotional responses that happen. So how I would understand all of these things is this. In our minds, like we tend to like compartmentalize, we tend to shut the doors in our mind. Right, like a house, and we don't commit. So sometimes there are rooms in our mind that the doors have been shut for a long time, and it's kind of dusty in there. And in the back of your mind, you know you really should go and clean that out, but you haven't, and you don't want to open the door and see what's there. And when we're meditating, we are in a healthy way gradually opening those doors. Yeah? And this is why I think meditation experiences are sometimes similar to drug experiences, because in drug experiences you can also open those doors, but you just do that because chemicals open them and it's not done through healthy development. So on the superficially it can seem like a similar experience, but it's not part of an overall emotional development. So these things open up, and when they open up, energy shifts. And that's how you experience it through all of these things. Like there's actually a relaxation and energy shifts, and then you feel these different emotions. So typically what that means is that you don't have to do anything. It will come to an equilibrium. All right? It will come. You might have these things recurring over some period of time. Like it might take a few weeks, a few months, usually not that long, but it can be easily a few months. You have these experiences happening, and gradually you will learn to get, they will come back to equilibrium, and then you'll find that you'll be okay, right? I had a lot of these things happening, especially when I was beginning meditation. First 2 or 3 years I was doing meditation, I had these experiences happening a lot, and gradually I learned to sort of come through to the other side of them. So when these experiences mature and when they come good, you feel what we call paranapiti or pervading piti. And pervading piti or pervading rapture is like a sense of joy or uplift which suffuses through your whole body and your whole mind. And it's very light, and it has like a zing or a zest to it. And it sustains for a fairly long period of time, okay? So once that paranapiti is settled in, it will stay there with the breath, inside the breath, can be for hours when you're meditating, just as long as you want to meditate for. And so then that will be, then that's when this is starting to stabilize. Now that joy and that rapture has an uplifting quality, and at the same time, underneath it, it also has a sweet and settling quality. And that sweet and settling quality we call sukha or pleasure. And this is the next development of the feelings in meditation. So sukha is sukha has in meditation has this almost it's a sense of tranquility. It's almost like molasses or something. It's like a sense of tranquility, but it's so settled that you like you just not don't move. It's not like you're just still. It's like the movement is gone, you know, and it feels like there's this profundity to that pleasure and that happiness. But when you experience that, then it is so comfortable. It's so comfortable that you like the restlessness is gone. You don't want to move in your meditation. You don't want to move at all. You just want to stay there. It's like you're now curled up on your comfy chair by the fireplace with a cat purring in your lap while you read your favorite book. And even though maybe you're like really tired, you don't want to go to sleep because you're just so happy to be there. And that's the kind of that feeling that you have in meditation then. It's just like you're just almost stuck, but not stuck in a bad way, but stuck in a good way. So you're not like fighting to be in that place. You're not like, oh, my mind's distracted, I'm coming back or something like that. You're just content to be there. That's that deep experience of sukha. And that sukha leads directly to samadhi or unification of mind and then to liberation, which I'll talk about more next week. So this is the development of pleasant feelings in meditation. And these pleasant and happy feelings, I cannot emphasize enough, are accessible to anyone who develops meditation. If you develop meditation regularly and if you are doing it while properly cultivating these emotions and so on, then you can experience these pleasant feelings through even like a fairly standard meditation practice. I'm not talking, and just to sort of make sure that we're clear here, I'm not talking about any profound attainments of meditation. I'm not talking about jhana, I'm not talking about samadhi. These feelings will come up long before we have any deep realizations or deep insights. They're a normal emotional reaction. They're just a development of that ordinary feeling of happiness at doing good. Okay? When you give a gift to somebody, you feel happy. What we're experiencing meditation is simply a development of that same feeling. Okay? Now, in Buddhism, of course, the purpose of the Buddhist path is not for experiencing happy feelings. And I will talk about more of this in coming weeks, but ultimately we practice for Nibbana, we practice for liberation. And the Buddha described Nibbana as Paramang Sukham. Nibbana and Paramang Sukham. Nibbana is the ultimate happiness. And somebody once asked Venerable Sariputta about this, how can Nibbana be the ultimate happiness when everything has ceased? There's no feelings in it. And Sariputta said, it's the ultimate happiness precisely because there are no feelings in it. Which we might discuss further later on. But the main point of what Sariputta was saying there is exactly what I've been talking about in this talk, that the cessation, that sensation of happiness, right, the pleasure that we're feeling comes from the ending of those things that oppress us. And when those things that oppress us end, we are free. And that freedom of Nibbana, the happiness of Nibbana is freedom. So it doesn't consist of any one thing. It consists of the freedom from that which is oppressing us. So in meditation, we experience that freedom in a positive sense as an actual sensation of happiness. But at a deeper level, the sense of freedom is an even more profound manifestation of that same liberation. So this is a few words for you this evening on happiness and pleasure in meditation. I hope that was fun. And any questions? And for those online also, if you have any questions, please. Yeah.
You spoke to the beginning stages of your practice and experiencing certain experiences.
Of course, yeah.
And then said, now you're on the other side. Other side of things.
Sorry? Oh, yeah, having the strong rapture experiences and things like that, yeah.
But then you almost pointed to now you're on another side of it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, got past it.
Could you talk about more of that? Just because I had similar experiences in the sense
of
a lot of other worldly experiences, particularly in the fourth year of my practice, I'm now 11 years in. And my practice is very ordinary now, which is wonderful. But I just want to hear your perspective.
Sure. I mean, would you want to share what your extraordinary experiences were?
It's just my extraordinary experiences. Yeah. Very much what you were saying. I experienced all of that. So.
Okay. And was there anything that consciously shifted, or did you just move past it?
I think I did the dance of attachment and aversion.
Nice, yeah.
And then I was like, I didn't feel much towards any of it.
I used to get a lot of different kinds of things like that, but mostly I experienced like movements in my body, which at some times when I was meditating was extreme, like really extreme, like my first retreat. So I went through a period in my first retreat when I would meditate, I put my hands in my lap, and my thumbs would touch, and as soon as my thumbs touched, I'd get an electric jolt through my entire body, and I would leap up from a meditation seat and throw myself on the other side of the room. Without any permission or control, just go. But then I went to my meditation teacher and I asked him, I said, what's that? What did I do? He said, just notice it. Yeah. The side of that. That's almost not quite what they said. What they said was, he said, your gateway to insight is not self. Yeah. So you seem like you're losing control. Like these things are losing control. So that's how that insight is actually manifesting meditation. Right? Yeah. So these things that extreme period then, went away, but it would come and go for quite a long time. And eventually my meditation teacher, Dr. Mahachachai, he gave me the advice. He said, when you experience those kinds of rapture, like out of balance or extreme forms of rapture, look for the happiness inside it. Look for what is tranquil inside it. And there's something in there that you're not seeing, right? There's like a dimension of it that you're not seeing. And so that's when I went away and I meditated and I just learned to see that, and then, that just all finished. Yeah. It's literally just shifting your perception a tiny bit, and then you just saw that it's just gone. Yeah.
It did dissolve more so when I stopped defining it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But again, for people generally, these things can sometimes happen and sometimes they don't. It's not necessary, but it's important to talk about it because it does happen. Right, and you feel weird and alone when it's happening, and you are weird and probably alone. but not as weird and alone as you think you are. So a few people are leaving. Shanti is here. So we should wrap up soon. We also don't want to keep going too late because we don't want to keep the nice staff here at the venue late. Sorry, Niluji. Okay.
Which is just 2 minutes walk from here.
Okay, excellent.
Just
awesome.
Get together, get to know each other, come and jump.
Thank you so much, Pat. So look, let's wrap it up there because we should have to wrap up for the venue. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. And it's really a pleasure and an honour to spend time with you all. As you know, this course will continue for the next 2 weeks. Subsequent to that, the session will continue, but it won't be specifically on this early Buddhist meditation course. And the course is being run parallel in Parramatta at 5 Parramatta Square, and that's starting at 6 on Tuesdays. And that one is not recorded. So if you want to come along in person, then welcome. As Pei just said, going for dinner afterwards. Please see Pei if you want to join in, and that's just a nice chance to get to know people and so on. And also for those folks in Europe, you're most welcome to join us for dinner if you like. But if you want to let us know, they can maybe like jitsi in at the dinner table or something like that, and I don't know how that works. But anyway, we'll just know that you're sharing the meal in our hearts, I guess. I'm not sure. Anyway, so thanks everyone, and see you next week.